This is ABC Radio Brisbane with Steve Austin.
10:35. Thank you so much. Yes, all the same flowers. $20, please. Have a nice day.
20 minutes to five. I'm running late, but let's look at the cathedrals of capitalism in which you and I spend nearly a third of our life, apparently, shopping in some form in shopping centres, whether they be strip centres, of which there's only a few of them left, or the mega centres, or even Toombul, where Gary Mortimer shops, the professor of business at QUT's Business School. Gary Mortimer, welcome back. Associate professor, I'm sorry, I promoted you.
Nearly there.
Nearly
thanks,
there.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. Great to be back.
Dominique Lamb. Dominique is the Chief Executive Officer of the National Retail Association. Welcome back, Dominique.
Thank you.
And Christine Moody is the founder of Brand Audits. Christine, welcome back to you.
Hi, Steve.
Christine, do you notice that you're starting to get charged when you do a tap-and-go payment?
Well, I don't notice this, but I believe it is happening. We've been talking about this on air before where all these little fees are coming in, but the different banks have different charges, and it's like everything else. You've got to actually check it and ask your bank how to use that card in the best possible way. So I have debit cards as an example, and I use them certain ways.
Smart woman.
But you've got to work out how to do it. You've got to actually ask the bank and actually check your statements and ask the question at your bank.
I ask this because the big four banks have announced that they're developing systems to reduce the cost of processing PayWave purchases. In the meantime, the Australian Retailers Association say it costs business around $500 million a year. Now, I thought the cost of electricity and PayWave purchases were supposed to be negligent, but this has been happening for a while as far as you're concerned, Dominique.
Yeah, look, in fact, about 12 months ago, it was one of the top three concerns of our members. So definitely those fees from merchant banks that they were receiving, and they certainly were passing them on to consumers.
So the banks were charging businesses. The businesses were going, hang on, how am I stuck with this?
Well, that's right. And because of, I guess, you know, just the state of the economy and how much people are spending, they just haven't had too many options other than to pass it on. So it is certainly something that we've been advocating about for, you know, a good 5 years or so now. And it's just something that hasn't changed, and it certainly isn't changing quick enough for our members' liking.
Gary, the big four banks say they're developing systems to reduce the cost of processing PayWave purchases. Mm. We were pushed into this system. This was the big four banks that came up with it in the first place.
Yeah, but is it the case we've been pushed into it, or is it the case that the way we now transact is that we actually like that convenience of tap and go?
Mm. Well, it's called nudge economics. You know, you're nudged into it.
Yes.
They don't put a gun to your head and say, you know, hand over your PayWave. They just say, you know, they put incentives into the system, and then when the other one drops off, they say, and now we'll start charging you.
Yeah, yeah.
That's called organised crime.
There's a bit of science behind it, and we look at sort of transaction decoupling. So once you remove the sort of act of actually physically giving over cash, we know we tap and go and spend a lot more than we normally do. And studies have been around since the 70s. Richard Thaler was doing stuff in this space a long time ago, that if you give people a credit card versus real cash, you spend more on the credit card and less on the cash. So I guess I'm probably...
He got a Nobel Prize for it, didn't he?
He did, yeah. So, and that's really the fundamental difference, is that if you take your $100 out at the start of the month and go, that's my money for coffee and whatever I'm going to spend, then you spend that $100. Once it's gone, it's gone. But if you don't take the cash out and you're just tapping and going, I mean, I look at my daughter's credit card, not her credit card, her debit card statement. I sit there with her statement and go, look at all the little sort of minor purchases you've made and how much you've added out over the month.
But don't forget too, like my phone and my credit cards are on my phone with Apple Pay. Mm. So I've got my mobile phone with me, so that's what I use to tap and go. So I won't tell you which bank, I won't advertise that, but I've selected that particular card that's on there because it doesn't have any fees.
How much of an issue is it for your members, Dominique Lamb, the National Retailers Association members?
Yeah, look, definitely it is costing them a fortune. And as I said, you know, they really don't have much opportunity but to push it on. In some cases, you know, obviously where they spend more money, it's not such an issue. But more and more we're seeing small businesses certainly really feel the pinch. And this is just another cost that, you know, is pushing them kind of under.
This is ABC Radio Brisbane. My guests are Dominique Lamb from the National Retailers Association, Christine Moody, founder of Brand Audits, and Gary Mortimer, associate professor at QUT's Business School. The Banking Royal Commission. Many small businesses have gone under after reckless or negligent treatment by staff working for the big four banks. What are you seeing so far? Anything else that stood out to you at the moment? The financial advisors are in the dock. I believe a witness has just collapsed, by the way, in the Banking Royal Commission. So I'm not sure who that is, but there was some very colourful toing and froing between the counsel assisting and one of the witnesses from the Financial Planners Association, I think it was, earlier this morning. What are you seeing in the Royal Commission? Dominic, is there anything that's standing out to you or Gary?
Well, funnily enough, I was having this discussion in relation to the franchising Senate inquiry that's about to come because...
When does it start? It's not far away,
is it? It's not far away. So it's just in early May.
Right.
But they're certainly accepting, I think submissions then, and they'll have 10 days before they start hearings. But look... You know, in the end, when you go to borrow money to start a business, including a franchise, often a bank would ask you to submit a business plan, and that business plan has to be quite detailed. And then based on that business plan, you know, you may or may not be, you know, provided with those funds. I think in a lot of these situations, it to me looks like perhaps the banks haven't done their due diligence in terms of lending. And whilst we know, you know, certain franchise groups, you know, it means that they have to get legal advice and they have to get financial advice. I don't think that those financial planners or the people giving that advice have been scrutinised enough, especially when we've seen a number of them collapse recently.
But also, if you're very excited about that idea of getting that franchise, so some people don't want to start a business from scratch, they want to buy a business in a box, sometimes you're so excited that you may not take some of that advice on board. So even though, I mean, some of those stories are terrible and I get all that, but sometimes... you can get too excited and accept what you see and then...
Do your due diligence.
Yes. And
it's your money.
Yes.
You're going to lose it if you don't go through everything with a microscope.
Yeah, or step back and just get someone else that you really trust to sort of give you the other side of the story. Don't make the decision on the spot.
Not the organisation selling you the franchise.
Yeah, exactly.
You cannot accept their word at face value. They may be fine, but you just can't accept it at face value.
Or if they say, you know, it's not in the contract or something, we'll worry about that later. If it's not there, it's not there. So don't... Again, don't sign anything until you get advice.
And the issue with, and Dom's right, you need to provide a business plan, which is quite detailed, but essentially it's just a plan. You can never plan for, you know, things that will go wrong,
changes
in the economy. Yeah. And listen, I teach this, I know Chris teaches this as well, as, you know, how to write a marketing plan, how to write a business plan. And I see some great ones, I see some pretty terrible ones, but they're all quite subjective. Like what I read into a plan is completely different what a financial advisor might read into a plan. And ultimately, franchisors or any business, they don't want to see their franchisees or anybody else fail. They want to see successful businesses start up, particularly small businesses start up. So I don't think there's a malice, particularly from a franchise perspective. But we have to remember that these are businesses that are developing plans that are quite, can go wrong effectively.
My guests all work in the area of retail or branding. This is ABC Radio. I work for the ABC, which is an honour, quite frankly. Someone said, how's work? And I said, I don't work. I have a job that I love. What's that saying that a man who goes to a work and enjoys his work never has to work a day in his life or something like that? That's a lovely phrase. Dominic, so the Senate inquiry into franchising is in a few days' time in May, early May.
Yes.
Is there anything that your organisation is alerting to people about or warning people about or wants the Senate inquiry to look at in particular?
Certainly for us, we will be making submissions. And I guess, we'll come from a few different perspectives because, you know, we have franchisees and franchisors within our membership group. But there's certainly issues, I think, you know, throughout the process. I mean, the code is very good and most franchise groups would certainly adhere to that code. But I think what it doesn't capture is actually the complicated nature of the actual arrangements between franchisors and franchisees.
Like,
and
you must buy your flour from this supplier.
Yes. Yeah.
I hear very funny stories from a whole range of...
But more than that, more in the sense that often franchisees aren't necessarily, or franchisors don't have the control to even look into compliance issues. You know, they might not all of them have the right to tell you who to buy from. Some of them only govern, you know, your marketing campaigns. You know, they're referred to as banner groups. Some of them are co-ops. And there's lots of really different arrangements, and I don't think all of them are captured by that code. So for us, it's really about diversifying and making sure that everybody's rights and responsibilities are clearly outlined.
This is ABC Radio Brisbane. John from Carralee sent me a note. He says, I've got 35 years in IT developing financial systems. He says, ever since banks invented direct deposit of wages and ATMs, they've been inventing systems supposedly to minimise the cost of face-to-face transactions. But the reality now is that fees are a substantial source of income for them. Noted, John. Thank you very much. A listener, Roz, has a question for you. Hopefully you can help. Can I ask my panel why a big shopping centre like Carindale does not have a post office?
Ooh, that is really quite irregular. I would
Didn't they have one and it closed? I could be thinking that's what
That might have what happened. It was there and it's not there
Pretty
anymore.
Pretty sure there is something about that because some of them are privately owned, as you know, or they're franchises
as
well.
They're franchises.
That's right. And I was going to say they're franchises. So,
they're franchises.
Depending on the cost of rental in those particular areas and locations, it just depends on whether it's viable for them to rent there. That's the end of it.
You've been expressing concern, Dom, about the cost that landlords are charging your members for rent in shopping centres. Do you hear any negative comments about the cost of rents at Carindale Shopping Centre?
No, not there in particular. In fact, that particular operator is typically quite good at interacting with the people that are, you know, selling there and looking after them if they are going through bad times.
Okay.
But
that's encouraging.
It's not everywhere. So, you know, we certainly from an industry-wide issue, it's still something that they want landlords to look at, especially given the current state of retail and, you know, what their growth is looking like.
And don't forget, Australia Post wouldn't pay any less per square metre than other it is what it is. So if, you know, the boutique next door, the Chanel, whatever, next door pays whatever, they'll pay the same.
So that's the answer, Roz. It's a franchise. So unless someone buys the Australia Post franchise and thinks they can make money in Carindale Shopping Centre, you don't get a post office in Carindale Shopping Centre.
That's right. That's why the footprint's quite tiny. Like, I know the one at New Farm is tiny and, the queue goes all over it because that's their footprint. They want to be able to do everything within that footprint. Mm.
This is ABC Radio Brisbane. Petrie Terrace, that quite funky, groovy shopping precinct that's trapped by roads or surrounded by roads. Mm. Hog's Breath Cafe has closed there. Mm. There's been quite a turnover, apparently. I think Native O Kitchen and Bar, then Burnt Ends, now Hog's Breath Cafe, have all announced that they'll be vacating the barracks complex at Petrie Terrace. What's going on there? What's the scuttlebutt? Anyone know?
It's a tough little centre when you think about it. I was talking to Dom in the green room about this, that if you're going in to dinner, you might go into a destination like West End or the Valley, catch a movie. Now, they've got movie up there. They've got a great supermarket up there. But you're right. It's landlocked by sort of major roads. It's busy coming out of town now, so people are driving past and they want to get home. And who is the demographic around it? Backpackers and younger people are generally in share houses that probably go to university. If we compare that particular sector of what I would refer to as inner city to, say, New Farm, Tenerife, that area, significant high-rise, significant population, good money, different demographics. So that's why I think we're seeing lots of work happening in that sort of gasworks area and certainly in the Valley. But I was thinking to myself, when the story came up, I went, I can't remember the last time I actually went in there. I mean, I go one of the restaurants in there occasionally, but generally I go into the Valley or I might.
What about there's a cinema? There's a cinema, palace.
It's a good cinema.
But I think that area would kick on. Like Caxton Street's great, but Caxton Street's great when there's a show on
football.
Or the football's on.
But also it looks hard. I think visually, to me, there's buses, there's all the directions on the road. I find that whole thing, it's just too hard.
Parking is not that easy.
You know, and it just looks too hard to do whatever you got to do, even to find the right road to get into, then you could turn right or whatever. I just go, no. I like to go somewhere I can just go, no, where I'm going, easy to park, I'm there. So I think that's part of it as well.
It may grow when sort of those little cottages fall away and they start to put up more of that high-rise, medium-density living that we're seeing in West End now and certainly in Tenerife and the Valley areas where you get more population in there. But really, if you look at the demographics, it's transient commuters going into work or getting out of city, going home, or backpackers and certainly younger cohort.
Might do better if the Roma Street train yards are developed because that's a bigger precinct. You know, there'll be residential, whatever. That might make a difference, but at the moment it's a little bit landlocked.
Mm. Robert sent me a note. Read the post office at Carindale. They complained their rent was too high and centre management couldn't give them a suitable smaller alternative site. Mm. So they moved to the Metropole about a kilometre away.
Right.
Robert, thank you very much. Very useful. Dom, Myer has a new chief executive, Mr. John King. Tell me about Mr. King.
So Mr. King has come from the UK. He's a bit of a retail veteran who led House of Fraser for 8 years. So he comes with a bit of a pedigree. He's certainly going to be paid very well.
How well?
Oh, well, how well?
I guess we'll find out in the annual report.
No, it's here. Am I about to faint?
Yeah, so the 55-year-old will be also able to earn more than $2 million a year.
Plus bonuses and
plus
shares.
Long-term and short-term bonuses. The share packages equates to about 24,400 shares, making it the sixth biggest holding in Myer based on its current ownership carve-up. So, look, he's definitely going to have a bit of an investment there, which typically can make someone more productive. He certainly has.
He's going to need to deliver, isn't he?
The skills he will need to deliver. And given the state of their board at the moment, obviously there's not going to be any concerns about getting rid of him quickly if he's not delivering. So I would imagine he'll have quite a short space of time to make some changes. But you know, it's good to have, you know, I think some new blood in there and somebody who's obviously got, you know, lots of experience, but it's still a difficult market, so we'll just have to see.
And House of Fraser went through what Myer and David Jones are going through. They're actually owned
what
by...
What is the House of Fraser all
it started,
in the UK?
It started as a drapery store in the UK in 1849. Two guys got together. And but anyway, it's gone through really what Myer and David Jones are going through. It sold to Chinese and then one big, huge Chinese company. It's now sold to another Chinese company. He left about that time, I think, when it was sold. But he's been through this, so he'll have strategies to go, yep, we've been through this. This is what we did. I mean, it's a different market. That'll be interesting to see how it's translated to ours because we are not the UK in size of population. But, yeah, he's had some training in that area.
It's interesting because DJ's CEO is also from the UK. So yes. I wonder what that's about, whether it's about kind of bringing that UK influence back into our lovely colonial
what
ways.
Does Solomon Liu from Premier Investments think about the appointment?
He's been quiet.
He's been quiet, hasn't
Very
he?
Very quiet.
Yeah. Let's ring him. No.
Mr. Liu, you're welcome on the program anytime. Please call 1300-222-612 is the phone number. Tell me then, while we're on about this, the Chinese online retail giant Alibaba, who are they and what are they saying about the future of retail, Dominique?
So Alibaba are a $32 billion company that comes out of China. And basically, they're a huge retailer that is predominantly online. But what they've actually started doing here is having pop-up stores to get Australians used to dealing with them. And they're saying that the future of retail right now lies with facial recognition, which is certainly what we're seeing out of the US at the moment. And it's what a lot of big players are saying. I mean, what they're practicing is you can actually use a magic mirror where you sit in front of it, recognises your face, and then you can apply different makeups and do all sorts of things to yourself in this magic mirror. So it'll be very interesting. Their first pop-up store is in Melbourne, and they're using QR codes, which we don't see
Chinese.
A lot of in Australia.
Yes.
Yeah, but I have used them. I used to have them on the back of
they're
my
really
business
good.
Cards, and they would link back to articles that we wrote, but no one else seems to use them.
Over there, so they do a lot. I'm going over there next week, so I'll report back. But everyone uses them. But Alibaba has a big...
don't take
files.
Cash and don't take credit cards. I have my bride just came back from China and they don't take cash or credit cards. You pay WeChat or WePay.
Yes, that's right. Well, I do everything on
no
WeChat.
No WePay, no pay.
I do WeChat with everything. So it's good.
So Alibaba is the go. They're using QR codes and it will be coming here, Dom.
Yes, well, they are here. They're already here in Melbourne. So
here in Queensland, or we don't know?
No, not yet, but I would say that they'll definitely be expanding, and especially with all the developments here, you know, we certainly know that we attract a lot of Asian tourist spend, so I would think that we'll see a lot more from
Alibaba.
We
want their money when they come.
Yes, that's
right.
Definitely.
All right, very quickly, Uber have today launched a drop-off and pick-up service at select Westfield shopping centres.
Yep.
I'm sure the Taxi Council is currently writing an outraged press release. But what do you think of this? Uber has got special zones at certain Westfield shopping centres.
Well, they did a deal last year in 2017 with Westfield in the US. And they've got the proper little facilities. They've got a whole...
like a taxi zone.
It's
but this is even better. This is a lounge.
A lounge.
Where they have brand ambassadors to help you with your Uber.
A lounge?
Yes, a lounge. So it launched in...
Is there a dress code?
No, there's not. It's
probably.
Not quite that bad.
Probably a segregated. So probably a chairman's lounge. But yeah, so they're starting in LA, so probably...
Any of them here? Any of them here in Brisbane yet? I mean, it can't be far away.
Well, they're doing Bondi, aren't they? Not here yet, but it would be great at...
I think it's part of the course. I think now that Uber has fundamentally become a legal option, I think, you know, we need to find you know, shopping centres responding to it? I mean, you know, I was catching an Uber just recently and there was a whole pile of cabs. I could see people standing away from the cab rank waiting for their Uber whilst the cab rank was basically just cars lined up. So I think ultimately we've got businesses and shopping centres are no different from anywhere else sort of saying, well, we need space. I imagine state governments and local councils will be looking at this too, saying we've got cab ranks, we need to have Uber ranks or other types of ranks.
Well, they've been sort of lobbying for that. But I love the idea you can send your shopping there. So if you're shopping in various stores within Westfield, get your shopping sent there, go and pick an Uber. Everyone knows where you're going to be dropped off, picked up. It's easy. Get in the car and off you go.
In a lounge.
Yep. You can just imagine it'll be.
That's what I call competition.
It's definitely competition. It's disruption, Steve.
Yeah. It's disruption. Yeah. Thank you very much for coming in. Dominic Lamb, CEO of National Retail Association, Christine Moody, founder of Brand Audits, Gary Mortimer, Associate Professor of QUT's Business School. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to ABC Radio Brisbane with Steve Austin.